are number 24. It's only four pages. I thought it was going to be a lot thinner. I thought it was going to be about two. We're in the middle of the seven trumpets, and finally we are at number seven. So, just to briefly recap where we are, we're in the middle of the sequence of seven trumpets. We had just gone through kind of an interlude, an interruption between the sixth and the seventh, and you might consider it an expansion of the sixth trumpet. Well, the interlude described what may have been happening from a different perspective there. Reminders that trumpets were sounded during the morning sacrifice ritual at the Jewish temple. So the scene that we need to imagine in our minds, the scene that happened every day, every morning at the Jewish temple. Trumpets were sounded as the morning sacrifice was offered. And these trumpet events that we have been reading so far in Revelation have to do with judgments that were experienced by those who are not God's servants. During the interlude that we discussed in the previous two sessions, it described God's servants who were under protection while these judgments were falling upon the earth. We saw that described as the measuring of the temple. Alluded to an Old Testament description, a couple of descriptions where either the temple or the city of Jerusalem was being measured and those inside it were under protection. The interlude described the church as victorious even when it appears dead for a period. So the church and is the two witnesses in the previous passage is a description of the church and its mission. So this mission of the church was proclaiming the gospel, but also the gospel is also a message of judgment because it requires a decision by its hearers. Either a person accepts what the gospel message has to say about Jesus, about the world, and all of everything surrounding it, or they reject it. And so with that background now, let's read the next few verses of chapter 11 of Revelation, 15 through 19. Rather short passage today. Then the seventh angel blew his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. And the 24 elders who sit on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worshipped God, saying, We give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, who is and who was, for you have taken your great power and begun to reign. The nations raged, but your wrath came, and the time for the dead to be judged, and for rewarding your servants, the prophets and saints, and those who fear your name, both small and great, and for destroying the destroyers of the earth. Then God's temple in heaven was opened, and the ark of his covenant was seen within his temple. There were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and heavy hail." We see right off that the scene, which was pretty much kind of judgments that were falling upon the earth in the previous six blowing of the trumpets, the scene has now reverted back to heaven, kind of back to where the seven seals have been. We see that because of the mention of the 24 elders. If you recall, the 24 elders were around the throne of God and of the Lamb. They had their own thrones around it, and they were in constant worship of God and the Lamb, except for that brief moment of silence as the trumpets were being blown. But now you see that worship resumes. And the proclamation, the loud voices proclaim that Jesus is resuming full authority and reign over the earth. This scene ends with the temple becoming opened. But earlier, we've already seen the inside of the temple, so what exactly is happening here? We need to go back to the description of the temple, the description of the sanctuary in the Old Testament, where there were two compartments. No, actually there were three separations. There was the courtyard, and then there was the holy place, and the Holy of Holies, or the Most Holy Place. So three compartments. We have already been in the holy place because the altar of incense played a prominent part in earlier parts of Revelation, with the smoke of the incense representing the prayers of the saints rising to God. And so when it says, then God's temple in heaven was opened and the ark of his covenant was seen, this is an indication that the innermost chamber is now open. When the scriptures refer to the temple, we have to figure out what exactly its context means. Because temple can mean the entirety, can mean kind of the holy place, or it can also mean just the Holy of Holies. And we see that kind of in the book of Hebrews, where the book of Hebrews talks about the temple quite a bit. And there's some confusion and disagreement as to what exactly the holy and the Holy of Holies and all of that means in the book of Hebrews. Similar thing happening here. But from the context, it's clear that it is now the innermost part of the temple that is being opened. Mentions the Ark of the Covenant. What is the significance there? And then there seems to be some further cataclysmic events, earthquakes, hail, thunder, lightning, rumblings that happen as this innermost compartment is opened. Is there any, you know, what does that mean? Is there any significance there? And where exactly does the description of the sounding of the seventh trumpet end? Now, is it with the hymn, or is it with the opening of the temple? There's some differences of opinion as to exactly where the seventh trumpet ends and the next act begins. Some background information. Let's see here. These are all from the InterVarsity Press Bible Background Commentary. Reads, although Judaism acknowledged God's present rule over the earth, it also awaited and celebrated his future rule unchallenged over all humanity, and it usually acknowledged Israel's rule over the nations on his behalf. In Jewish sources, this rule would be inaugurated at the very end of the age. The Jews had history divided into basically two, the present age and the age to come. The Messiah was the dividing line between the two different ages. What John is picturing through the book of Revelation is that because Jesus is the Messiah, Christians are living in the next age. Continuing on, the raging of the nations, God's wrath and the rule of Christ over the nations echoes Psalm chapter 2. Judaism held that the righteous were rewarded at the end of the age or at death. Destroyers and misusers of humanity's stewardship of the earth reversed the mandate God had originally given humanity. Humankind, they were given, the command was to take care of the earth. That was the original commandment. That was the very first commandment given to mankind. This idea was not unknown in John's day, although the unrighteous use of creation there may refer specifically to idolatry, speaking of the second book of Baruch. Many Jewish writers also believed that humanity's sin had corrupted the whole creation. The Ark of the Covenant was the piece of furniture in the tabernacle and temple that corresponded to a throne in ancient Near Eastern symbolism. The inclusion of the Ark thus fits the dual image of heaven as a throne room and as God's temple. Jewish hearers of the book would also be aware that the covenant had been deposited in the Ark and that the covenant was associated with stipulations and curses or plagues against the disobedient. The Dead Sea Scrolls and many apocalyptic writers felt that the old temple had been defiled, but that God would supply a renewed, pure temple at the end of the age. The Ark was kept behind a curtain in the Holy of Holies in the Old Testament, seen only by the high priest one day a year. Here it is exposed to open view. Finally, on the lightnings and related phenomena, so see comment on Revelation 4, 5. So we've seen these things before. This is Exodus language. So this Exodus language suggests that John's revelation is understood as a revelation on the same level as Moses's. Okay. So let us now continue down. Verse 15 speaks of loud voices. In previous occurrences of loud voices, they always described something or declared something that was important. And here it's no different. Something important is happening. And what is this important thing that's happening? Well, it's the transfer of kingship of the world from whoever held it now over to Jesus. So this world, which had been under the control of some power other than God, that authority is now being handed over to God.
Kind of more like God's reclaiming it as
true,
it is again.
True.
Since we basically in the past it was described as man not wanting his relationship with God, so God's invoking basically his relationship with us again, kind of thing. You know, like saying that he has declared us his again without us, his our need. I don't know. Yeah.
Verse 15 also speaks of our Lord and His Christ. It's an interesting way of describing things. If we go back towards the beginning, we had discussed that in the minds of the early Christians, perhaps there was some confusion as to the exact nature of God and Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so here John is saying there's our Lord, speaking of God, and His Christ, Jesus. They're pictured separately, but in the next phrase says, He shall reign. Who shall reign? Our Lord or His Christ? Now it's interesting that John doesn't write, they shall reign. The pronoun remains ambiguous, and as John has been doing numerous times, he's bringing the two together. John combines God and Jesus, communicating the message that Jesus is God.
And so this, they both together are referred to he, as he.
Right.
That makes sense.
And his reign is forever and ever. It's an unending duration. We examine the verb tenses in this verse, and what we find is that the transfer has happened in the past, but the reign is in the future. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. The transfer has taken place in the past, and he shall reign forever, somewhere in the future.
So are we still in that in-between space?
It's a good question.
2,000 years later, are we still after the transfer and before the reign? Or does the reign have different components, different parts? The already and the last day.
Well, it's already, because in the last interlude we were given that hope by John saying that all of this has happened and all of the rewards of being in God's, in the fear of God in the right way, is those blessings are happening to those right now, and all of these things that are the dramatic things that are supposed to happen to people are already happening to them. So, quote unquote, it seems like it already happened.
And then he is already reigning, but we just don't see the full fruit of that.
No, if you're reading Revelations, you do, because that's what John was saying in the last one. Was like, this is for those that are with me on this one. Kind of assume this is for those that are with me on this. All the rest of these guys are going to be going through this, but I mean, they're always saying that the. I don't know if there's an end time.
So we do have the fruit of his reign. We do have the experience of his reign, but there is something else to come later that will be better.
Well, they say future.
Someday in the future, there will be something even more. But we do have.
It says Christ. And he shall reign forever and ever. It sounds more to me like this has happened, and it's going to happen forever now, from now on.
Yeah.
Period. Like, this has happened, and now it's for the rest of eternity. That's what I think. That makes me upset. I mean, totally.
Okay. Verse 16 speaks of 24 elders who resume their worship. We've already seen these 24 elders in chapters 4, 5, and 7, in conjunction with the prelude to opening the seals and the interlude between seals 6 and 7. And they have always been in the context of worship. Verse 17, there's this phrase, who is and who was. In all recent translations, who is to come is not present. In some of the older, such as the King James, who is to come is added, based upon some of the manuscripts that particular translation was based on. Because in earlier occurrences of this phrase, who is and who was, it was always and who is to come. And so to make it consistent.
So they added it.
Some scribes, when they were way back in, had inserted notes of these additions to make it consistent. But it's not present in the oldest manuscripts. Who is and who was. Who is to come is no longer present, needed, because who is to come is come when the seventh trumpet sounds.
Who is and who was and has come.
The reason for the coming in Revelation is judgment. The judgment is here, and so who is to come, the reason for that is no longer there.
if you take out all of the dramatic fire and brimstone of John's message and just plainly state that if you understood what you read before this time, then you're already with God here, and the judgment part was already there from the beginning of your reading and your teaching. It was already there, and you're just kind of becoming aware of the fact that there's a separation between being with God and not being with Him. And that's kind of really, like, all the rest of the stuff, it seems like a lot of theatrical stuff, but when you really break it down, it's just the difference between being with God and not being with Him is the judgment. The judgment is whether or not you're going to make a decision to be with or without Him. Mm-hmm. And like, the come part is truly not needed, because who was is all it said, because that is all that's needed.
Mm-hmm. So it's like you could take out all the fire and brimstone and have maybe a message that is more applicable to us today.
Well, not, yeah, absolutely. And then more so than that, it makes it less of like this
threat.
Well, right, when you read it, it doesn't seem so like
scary,
contrasting to what you just read. You know, you just read through all of Acts and Corinthians, and yeah, and you think of this loving affection of God, and you've come to this place where you're together with Him, and then all of a sudden it's like, but wait.
We need to go fire and brimstone now.
But it's not really that at all. Mm-hmm. It's just saying that this is the, in their best way, effort to say that this is what life would be like without God. Mm-hmm. Is that, am I kind of close on that there? Is it like,
that makes sense
to me. Maybe.
Let you finish your sermon here. Hey, I've got to fill in.
So this song that the elders are singing describes the Jesus has taken power. The verb tense here is what's called the perfect tense. Something that has already happened and its effect is ongoing. And begun to reign, the verb tense is what's called the aorist. There's really no time specifier for aorist tenses, although it is usually something that has happened in the past. It's something, an event that has happened. It's not an ongoing thing, but something that has happened. And so what we can kind of conclude is that the transfer of power to Jesus in His reign over the world begins prior to judgment itself coming. We could identify that the cross and the resurrection event of Jesus is the transfer. That's when the transfer of power took place. Mm-hmm. We also discussed at the very beginning of this series of trumpets, that the sounding of the trumpets, that the very first trumpet began to sound at the cross and the resurrection. It's when the gospel began to be proclaimed. The seventh trumpet describes the conclusion of the judgment. So there's different ways to interpret the time period in which these seven trumpets occur. So there's one way of interpreting it is that it's all happened. Another way of interpreting is that all of it is still to come during the time of wrath or time of trouble. And another way of interpreting it is that the first trumpet began sounding when Jesus completed his work on earth, and that it, the trumpet sounding is continuing, and that we are currently somewhere in the series of trumpets. But we haven't yet experienced the seventh. Because when the seventh trumpet sounds, that's when judgment, the work of judgment, the work of proclaiming the gospel ends. The song that the elders are singing continues in verse 18. And it's, there's this phrase, nations rage. And this is referring to Psalm chapter 2. And we've already mentioned Psalm chapter 2 in this previous, earlier discussions. It's a fairly short psalm, I believe. Let's see, yeah. It's only about 12 verses, so I will read the whole thing here. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. Thinking back to some of the, especially in the sixth trumpet description, there's quite a bit of imagery and phrases and words that are similar to what's found in Psalm 2. So you could say that John is bringing that imagery of God appointing his son as ruler over the earth, and the resulting judgment for those who have rebelled against him.
It's almost like when you try to describe it, trying to describe God's wrath is almost as difficult in human terms as describing his glory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you have here John and these depictions of the seven trumpets and the seals and revelations as a whole, trying to, in human terms of their time, to depict
the emotions of God.
That and what it would be like to not be part of his world. And it's an almost impossible thing in our literary ability to be able to write it down and then even have people understand and convey us when we do.
What's interesting,
2,000 years later to comprehend.
Yeah, that's even harder.
What we as English speakers, as Western thinkers, fail to realize is that in the Hebrew, the words love and hate, there's no emotions attached to it. Love is simply a choice to prioritize that which is loved above that which is hated. Hated is a lesser prioritization.
Huh. Interesting.
So that is, when you read Jesus's, some of Jesus' sayings, you know, you have to hate your family, hate your mother, your brothers and sisters. It doesn't mean to hate in the English Western sense. It means to place them at a lesser priority than your choice for God.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't say you're not supposed to have affection for them.
Yeah, to cast all of your emotion from this and go only to God.
Some people take that literally. Yeah. Bad. Totally.
The same thing with, you know, words like wrath. The wrath isn't our image of anger.
Passionate anger.
It's not passionate anger. As we discussed while we were going through Romans, Paul's understanding of God's wrath was simply giving people up to the choices of rejecting God.
Right.
The consequences of rejecting God.
Yeah.
The consequence of rejecting the source of life. If you reject the source of life, you don't have life. Mm-hmm. You have chosen death.
You've chosen to be in a bad place, which could be described as fire and brimstone.
Well, yeah. It's even worse than that because it's uncomprehendable. You can't even begin to describe it because you don't even really. You can't describe what God's glory is, and you can't describe what a life without Him would truly be like.
If Paul was living in the 21st century, might he describe the wrath of God as
losing your iPhone and being stuck in somewhere that you didn't know you were?
Or as being on a spaceship and walking out of the airlock into a vacuum of space.
Yeah.
I think that can be a description of the wrath of God. The vacuum of space.
Yeah.
Or making the choice to not live.
Or watching your iPhone fall in the toilet.
Well, the literal terminology of some of the descriptions that we're reading would have a person like Mark is saying in the English language going, "You've got to be kidding me.
This is crazy."
Yeah, what I believe the Bible describes, it has God's grace has many facets. One of it is a general grace and mercy that's being afforded to everyone, regardless of their choice for or against God. And what part of the judgment is God is saying, you know, I'm honoring your decision. I'm withdrawing the grace that has, you know, kept everything fine for you. But I can't do that forever. Where's the freedom of choice?
You choose to be without it, you're in a vacuum.
Yeah, I have to honor your choice to live apart from me.
So here's your world apart from me.
Yeah.
And it's full of demons and guys running after and marching millions of people.
I think the vacuum of space where there's nothing there whatsoever, it would be more descriptive than fire and brimstone. Because that's, fire and brimstone is an active process.
Maybe it's living life as a corporate lawyer.
Fire and brimstone is a much more vindictive, passionate, active process of nastiness being thrown at you. The vacuum of space is existing in a place where there is nothing. Where everything that you had been depending on and didn't realize it, everything that was keeping you alive and sane, no longer exists.
So the nations raged. The nations refer to all those, you know, basically who have rejected God. Mm-hmm. The outer courtyard in the previous session,
which was not measured.
Which was not measured, was given over to the nations. They were allowed to trample and plot against the witnesses. Mm-hmm. Nations' rage is contrasted with God's wrath. And God's wrath is this judgment process that takes place, as we've already discussed. God's wrath and judgment is giving people over to the consequences of their rebellion and their rejection of life. The elders continue that the time has come for judgment, where the dead are judged, and the servants of God, the church, represented by the phrase prophets and saints, the ones who fear God, are rewarded. It's interesting that this song says the dead are, the time has come for the dead to be judged. Are they literally dead, or are they dead in a metaphorical sense because they have rejected the source of life?
Do you ever think that as humans, with our very short attention span and blip here, that sometimes we, even as slowly as we've gone through all of this information, just through the New Testament, and as slow as we've gone through it, it sometimes feels to me that we even go just that much too fast through this sometimes. Because honestly, like, without you really going over it for us and being here with us to teach us it and to frame it in such a way that we can take this time to learn it,
we can't comprehend.
As a human, we're just sitting here reading through this book going, what in the world? But to take this information and really absorb it slowly would give you a much... I mean, because you can go to church for once a week on Sunday for 10 years out of your life, and if you only hear just a couple... You know, you hear a sermon every Sunday, you're not actually really getting a very in-depth, intimate reading of this information that's broken down this way, that's digested. And it can be so just misunderstood, or not even misunderstood, but just not digested. It can just be taken in as kind of a...
Or like, sometimes you hear just one verse out of a chapter and it'll be used, but you don't know any of the background around it, so... So now every time I hear one verse by itself anywhere on the radio, or something, I'm wondering, what's the rest of it sound like now?
Especially if you hear somebody beating somebody over the head with a single verse.
Yeah, then I'm like,
very often it's the context and the information is used as an opinion point.
Where were the people then, that heard it in their understanding?
Exactly.
Where were they already, and why was this said?
If you look at it different.
It's so much like this, the reading of all of these is strange. Familiar to the sequence of a human life, like maybe some of these things are information that you can learn quickly and absorb and understand, but may not necessarily sink in until you're in certain aspects of your life at the time when you're in them to truly understand, like the feelings of the reinitiation or rebirth to your relationship with God. Like, that's something you could read 100 times, but until you actually get to a point in your life where you really do actually have a new beginning and a new relationship between you and God personally, does that information ever even really make sense until that time?
Mm-hmm.
And then you read through Acts and you read through
the New Testament,
and you start to understand.
It actually means things now.
Here is this coming of Christ now. Here is this revelation of a new guard. And you keep taking these contexts as you grow through this procession or the lineage. And it's like, it's very amazing that there is an extremely large amount of information that is just totally taken for granted and skimmed right over, and usually utilized as like an opinion-based tool to say, okay, you're doing this wrong, and let's follow me or something like that. Pardon me, that's very long-winded. But thank you, Mark.
So,
where were we?
Talking about the dead. Talking about the dead. The phrase dead, in our minds, it immediately conjures someone who is physically dead.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important, especially when reading what's in the Bible, to get the context as to what the author means by dead. John here is John here is contrasting the dead to the servants of God. Okay, so there are no dead servants of God. That doesn't mean everyone's going to be physically alive when this takes place. But it's important to understand that when John writes the dead are judged, he's not meaning all who have ever died physically in the history are going to be judged, because for John, judged has a very negative connotation. It's those who have rejected God, who are spiritually dead, whether they are physically dead or physically alive, who are going to be judged.
So, with the way we've always heard it, God's going to judge, God's going to pass judgment, either good or bad, on all the dead people. And then when he runs out of dead people, then he starts judging the living people. And we never know when that's going to happen, and our moment could come up at any moment when he starts judging the living and all that. But that's not what it's talking about when he says he's judging.
At least not here. Not in this particular verse. He's for God, he knows who are dead and who are his servants. He doesn't have to go through some lengthy process of trying to figure it out. God is God.
And I've not the numbers on either side in a book or something like that.
But what it also says is there is no intermediate position. There's no one who is in that in-between state of not belonging to God or not belonging. No.
There isn't any purgatory.
There's no third choice. You're either for or against God. So the question was kind of asked earlier, when do these things take place? Well, the verb tenses of God's actions that are taking place in verses 15 to 19 are nearly all in the aorist tense, which means it's a... Well, not necessarily, because an aorist verb can be used for things that are happening in the present as well as future. It's most often in the past, but by itself there's no indication of when it takes place. It's simply an action that takes place.
Happens, but it's usually used for something that has happened.
Correct.
Okay.
Some key exceptions to what God's actions take place here in is the word reign that we mentioned in verse 15, which is the future tense, the taken power in verse 17, the perfect tense. The fear of God's servants described in verse 18 is in the present tense, and those who destroy the earth are also in the present tense.
That's all still in the aorist tense.
Those four
are not aorist. Okay. They're future perfect and present.
Okay.
Now, the elders' actions that are described are in the present tense, I believe they were.
Okay.
So, one thing I think we can do to try to maybe clarify things is to ask the question, where is John placing himself as he describes these events? Is John placing himself as the narrator, as the one who is writing these events, at his time, which would be circa 95, the year 95, or is he placing himself at the time of whatever this final judgment is taking place?
Is he placing himself at a time at all?
Like, I suspect he's placing himself in the vision that he saw, which it doesn't really say when the vision that he saw actually takes place.
That's true.
If he is placing himself at his historical time, then the judgments have already begun, though the complete reign of Christ is still in the future.
Oh, I see. The verb use. Does the verb use refer to past, present, and future of his time or of the time of the vision?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Because as human beings, we are time-bound. When we describe things, we have to place ourselves in some point in time.
And that's why it's so difficult to explain, to render any sort of description of God, because it would be, it's there.
Because so many of the descriptors needed to describe God don't conflict with the world in which we exist.
We can't describe something that doesn't exist on a linear timetable.
Yes.
It's impossible. There's no way to even, in our focus, our vision, our everything that we do is non, it's not capable of depicting in entirety.
But it kind of looks like he's using the verbs in relation to the vision rather than in relation to the time he's sitting on.
So if John is placing himself at the time this vision events are taking place, not the vision, not when he received the vision, but when the vision, the events described as a vision are taking place, then some events may have begun that's described, such as Jesus receiving power and authority, and others still in the future for John and for us. So John may have only experienced personally the first one or two of the trumpets sounding.
But when he says this has happened in relation to the vision, doesn't necessarily mean that that has happened at AD 95.
Correct.
Makes sense.
And now maybe it's a combination of both.
Yeah. Well,
that's why John uses these verb tenses that are very ambiguous to us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What if all of this is also taken into the consideration that these are all personal more of a, instead of all encompassing the entirety of mankind itself, like I was saying, is more often I look at this and it speaks to like a personal level of your own life as you're reading through these things, and it seems like if you're
supposed to be this event is going to happen at such and such a date, and how much of it is talking about experiences in.
Well, what's happening as far as your relationship is concerned with God and the church?
Different people will have at different times, and that
because you're here and you're in your revelation point of the judgment that you know is upon the world and yourself mostly. Like, instead of saying that this is happening to specifically John and the world as a whole at this time, how is it happening to a singular person who might be understanding and living through these books and reading and understanding this? So that, like, at this point in time in your life, you're coming to this crossroad after you've said yes or no, and this is the sides of the fence that you are and aren't on and are going to continue to portray and be a part of.
Everyone experiences these events at different times, and that could also be a reason for some of the ambiguous verb tenses?
I think so, yes, because here you're looking at it, and this could pertain to an entire group of people, it could pertain to just John, or it could pertain to a single person's relationship with God, his judgment that will be passed, and the world around them if they choose to decide to work with or not work with God.
And if you're not saying we have to figure out what date this particular thing happens on, and if you're saying this is about how we relate with God and the people around us,
gosh, you could really go crazy trying to get a specific date out of this.
Which people have done over the years.
I have no idea.
Well, it adds a lot of comfort to me in a way that this gives me a focus on which side of the fence I'm going to land on and how I should conduct myself if I want to hit that point. And
which
it's not offensive on? When you feel this way about it. It's more of an actual... It's a very well-framed guideline, like, okay, this works for an individual to be able to say, John is saying, well, we've had this time where man has let go of the church, Christ already came, what are you doing about it with your faith in God? How are you practicing? And I'm sure it's probably not about just a personal message to oneself, but...
It's primarily to a church.
Yeah.
But it's still a personal message to a people.
So it's a message to someone else, but how do we use it 2,000 years later?
Okay.
So finally, last verse of this chapter. Verse 19. So we've already mentioned, John has already seen the altar of incense. So the temple is already open to the holy place. So when it says the temple is opened, clearly, with the revelation of the Ark of the Covenant that is now seen, this verse refers to revealing of the Most Holy, or the Holy of Holies. And in some ways, I think it parallels what happened at Jesus' death with the tearing of the veil in the Jerusalem temple. There was a veil that separated the holy from the Holy of Holies. And when Jesus died, the veil was torn top to bottom. And it revealed the inner sanctum, where God was believed to reside. The Ark of the Covenant is the significant object in the Holy of Holies. It represents Israel's version of an ancient deity's throne. The pagan other temples, other sanctuaries, other buildings of worship that the Israelites had around them, they were very similar. Even the dimensions of the building were very similar. And all of them believed that they had an object, and usually the image of a god was in the most holy of these places. Well, Israel could not make an image, obviously, because that was the first two commandments. But they had the ark. The ark was where it was believed that God rested, this invisible god. That was the throne. But what was the point of God commanding Moses to build a temple? Why did God come to Israel at Sinai? Because he wanted to be with his people. He wanted to be with Israel. So the Ark of the Covenant also represents God reaching out to humankind.
Does opening the temple and the veil wasn't just split open, it was like ripped open by the heaven.
Yeah, it was torn open.
And so when you're saying, like, Israel's always, they were always closing up the last part of God, like only one person saw it one time.
The high priest, once a year on the Day of Atonement, was allowed to go in
and see the holiest of holy.
Right.
But now God is saying
everyone
can see the holiest of holy all the time.
Right.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
So the ark also symbolized God's presence in Israel. When Israel went out to war, they sometimes took the ark with them because they believed
in God. They're taking God with them.
Yeah.
Yep, but he's got
his bomb. But that was the problem with the temple in the first place, though, right? I mean, that's why God is open. That's why John's saying that it's open now. Like, it's not... Like, God is no longer behind... He's not Oz anymore. It's not behind a veil. We're not, you know, a small amount of people of the church holding on to the sanctity of God. Everybody in this church now is available to this sanctity if they'll take it.
The priesthood of all believers kind of thing.
And that's why he's talking about all of the saints and prophets, because the church of the people that truly believe in God are those saints and prophets, quote unquote. Maybe. You know,
cool.
Everything. Maybe I'm way off.
So is that why the most holy place is open?
Maybe.
I think it makes sense.
Maybe. Yep. So the top of the Ark of the Covenant was covered by what's called a mercy seat. It was a symbol of God's mercy. Mm-hmm. The Ark of the Covenant played a climactic role in the ancient Day of Atonement. That's when and the high priest was able to go in and sprinkle some blood to symbolize the purification of the entire nation once a year. And finally, its contents. It contained the covenant between God and Israel. Now we think of it as the Ten Commandments, or literally the Ten Words in Hebrew. It was a summary of the entire Torah, the law. For Israel, there was no difference between the Ten Commandments and the rest of the books of Moses. They were all one. It was the law. This covenant, especially if you look at places like Deuteronomy, describes curses and blessings, parallels to the judgment and rewards that John writes about in verse 18. And finally, the earthquake, lightning, thunder, hail. This would be the allusion to God who came down to meet Israel at Sinai. Well, there was a thunder, lightning, hail, a loud voice from the mountain.
So that could be not so much a threatening event, but a God is here with you.
Right.
Our best description of the most magnificent thing that we can describe to each other.
So as in, the temple is open. It's open to all of us, and God is here. Hey, that's cool.
Well, the other thing, too, is that John is still using Old Testament references to explain God being here, but the nation of Israel is not the nation of Israel in this context. It's the church, of the people of Christ at this time. It's the Ark of the Covenant is no longer where God is housed in the nation of Israel of the old time.
He's not limited to that location anymore.
It's not even limited to a location. It's that God is available through his promise to you as a whole God, that you are eligible for his presence now.
Some interpretations. God's revelation of himself that began at Sinai through the temple rituals. All of the temple rituals were instituted to help the people understand and to see and to experience God. This revelation continued in Jesus when Jesus came. And now, with the revelation that John is describing, it's complete.
Because at the time of Sinai, we were saying that we were able to see God. We needed a depiction and a letter to follow in order to know where we were.
Right. It was only a partial picture at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the high priest, the priest had a larger picture because of their closer access, and the high priest had the most access. And then there was Moses, which has no parallel. Moses saw God face to face, at least in one verse.
And at that time, the people were not willing to see God.
Correct.
Moses saw.
They asked Moses to be...
Bring him a king, right?
To be an intermediary. You speak to God.
Later there was...
And you speak to God for
there
us.
There were the judges, there were the priests, there were the judges, later there were kings. But first there was Moses. They said, you talk to Moses and then tell us. We can't handle talking to God ourselves. And now, at the very end, he's saying, I'm here.
Yeah, so people asked for an intermediary.
Uh-huh.
And that, may have worked out for a little while, but as things went on, history shows it didn't work out too well. Jesus comes to reveal God in the flesh.
To destroy the law, the Torah, and the stature that you... The ladder you'll never climb.
These are all the things that we've had for all these years instead of talking to God yourself, because you didn't want that.
So Jesus describes... Jesus showed God what God would look like in human form.
Uh-huh.
Revelation shows Jesus as God in his fullness.
Uh-huh.
And I think that may be one of the ways that we can look at why John sees the Ark of the Covenant in the temple, in his vision.
It's visible to everyone.
Another interpretation is that the work of atonement is finally complete.
Mm-hmm.
God's relationship with his servants, with his people, is fully restored. No further barriers exist. Well, it's not that God had placed those barriers, but it's that people had placed those barriers. Jesus came to take down those barriers.
Uh-huh.
That work of taking down barriers is now complete.
The people kept asking for barriers, people, walls, curtains in between them and God. They said, we can't handle being with God. Somebody else do it for us.
Well, it was in the beginning not even that we couldn't handle it, that we didn't want.
Right. The people said, we don't want that. We don't want this kind of relationship. Moses, you go have that relationship for us and tell us what it's about.
And even before Moses, at the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, they hid. They didn't want to see God when God came. God came to look for them.
Uh-huh.
So people have this history and pattern of hiding and placing barriers. Consciously or unconsciously, we do that.
When they had done what God told them not to do, they then ran away from God, hid from God, and were afraid to have that relationship. What if they had come out? God, we did what you told us not to do. What can we do? What if they
said? Don't know.
still probably be going through this because we still had eaten of the knowledge of good and evil.
Yeah, but maybe the experience could have been different if they hadn't hidden, and if people all down through history hadn't hidden from God and said, can we have a curtain here? Can we have a person to stand in between and have that experience instead of us having it? I mean, even though sin had entered the world, could the whole experience have been different?
So you mean if shame had never been involved in the act of that?
Yeah. If we had said, God, we did what was wrong, can we work together on fixing it? On figuring out what to do about it.
I think C.S. Lewis in one of the Chronicles of Narnia's books said it best, paraphrasing, that we're not given pictures of what could have been.
Uh-huh.
No, we only know what has happened, and we have to deal with that. God does not give us
what might have been.
Uh-huh. So to try to speculate on what might have been is kind of a useless exercise.
But it's interesting.
But right now, it does say right now that, like, our best shame for not being complete is the main thing that keeps us away from our relationship with God right now. Like, our own guilt, fear, and anticipation of the wrong act is what keeps us from that relationship. And if we didn't have the shame of doing something, well, we've done something wrong, but if we didn't have the shame of not being able to continue a relationship with somebody because we feel we've wronged them, then there wouldn't be such a trial between God and people.
We can never know what might have been, but what is to come is another matter entirely. And the context there was, we can never know what might have been if you had done this. But if you go do the very hard thing that I'm asking you to do now, what can happen? If you do what I'm asking you to do, it's another matter entirely. You can discover that.
Huh. And, yeah. Another possible interpretation of this Ark of the Covenant is that God's covenant is central to his work of handing out judgment and rewards. So that focuses on kind of the content of the Ark of the Covenant. So does verse 19 describe a summary of what has already come, or is it an introduction of what is about to appear? Not speaking of historically, but literary. No, does verse 19 describe a summary of the seven trumpets? And actually, a summary of pretty much everything that has come in Revelation up to this point. Or is verse 19 an introduction to the next act?
Sure.
If it's a summary, then the interpretations 1 and 2 that we talked about would be the primary interpretations. The significance is that the temple is fully open and exposed all the way to its inner sanctum. That relationship has been restored.
Okay.
If this is an introduction to the next section, then interpretation 3 is probably primary. The significance is in the actual Ark of the Covenant and the content of it, the covenant itself. And I bring this up because as we go on in subsequent chapters, it speaks about those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony or the witness of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The significance is in the content, the ark and its content, then the commandment becomes the covenant. The significance is in the open door. Then maybe the commandment is not necessarily the letter of the law, but rather what it represents. The covenant, what is the covenant? Covenant is an agreement between two parties. It's basically the ground rules for having a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So the open door will represent a relationship.
That's what it's been about the whole time. Restoring the relationship. So being able to see the content of the ark. You've read the contract. You know now that you what your barriers are and what your open relationship is going to be like.
In summary, we are now approaching the middle section of a dramatic form. We've talked from the very beginning that Revelation has some resemblance to a dramatic theatrical structure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a drama, typically has these elements, an exposition, where it kind of sets the setting, describes things. Of rising action, we have where different things are happening, tension increases, and then you have conflict and climax of falling action and what's called the denouement, where things finally resolve completely, you know, aftermath of everything. The next seven chapters, I believe, 12 through 18, I think, comprise the conflict and the climax. It's where the kind of the heart of Revelation is. It's where you hear the beast and the Babylon woman and the dragon and all of these other, the wars and all of these things happen. So
that we often think of as the meat of the
So the trumpets describe that judgment happens. So that's what we've seen, mm-hmm. but it kind of lacks specificity as to what this judgment, how it happens, why it happens, all of those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
This next act, the next 6-7 chapters, is going to go into detail. There's going to be two ways of looking at these. The next act, it can be seen as a completely separate thing, or it can be seen as fleshing out a lot of the things that we've seen already, from the letters to the seals to the trumpets,
mm-hmm.
filling in the details. And how we choose to interpret that can have a very dramatic effect on how we see or where these things happen. Because if we see the central section as something separate, then it's another part of history, either before or after what we've already seen. But if we see it as a part of those things that have already happened, well, it doesn't add anything new to the historical events of things that are happening. Which is important because the different churches, different denominations have hugely differing interpretations. Some think of the beast or the false prophet, the dragon, as literal beings that are going to represent literal beings that are going to appear, as opposed to some of the things that have already been described in the seals and the trumpets and the letters.
Mm-hmm. Literal beings or groups of people that will rise and fall in
right.
another group and so on. Hmm.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you're to take some of these if you're to take some of these depictions all the way back from the seven letters and try to describe them and use them for your opinion of the day that you're in, well then, there's been basically every generation has had their depiction of those characteristics all the time. I mean, what was going on when Hitler was happening? I mean, that had to have been like, you know, at that time, you could have been saying that these things that are happening, I mean, this is the end
Hitler
of the world type thing.
Myself character and so
right, and you're and you might be, you know, looking at it through these
Hitler
this slow pace and this
the Pope is this character
detailed. Depiction of it, it changes the fact that it's not today, or it's not something that we need to be looking at as like a Nostradamus foretale.
Yeah, recently, within the last few years, there's been some people that have shifted some of the talk of the beast and Babylon from Rome or the papacy to Islam.
Yeah.
No, because Rome and the papacy don't make a lot of sense in today's
so
world.
So to perpetuate the foretold prophecy ideology, you're just basically turning it from one bad scene in the world to the next and perpetuating on kind of a legacy of something that has that's unattainable, that hasn't happened yet, and that we'll never fully understand because it's not happening yet, but it's going to.
And if each particular character in Revelation has to symbolize a specific personality or group of people in the world, then who symbolizes what? Is going to change based on the time you live in.
Very
if
much
the
so.
Traditional Adventist interpretation had been had come to be during, say, the 50s, then Hitler no doubt would have been a very prominent character. It was before that. Hitler had not come about yet. So, the Pope is the most prominent character.
By turning this into a propaganda leaflet, in other words, and making this of the opinion of a church entity rather than of God's words to John, of revelation of our relationship and judgment personally between God and a human being, has given it the opportunity to be used as a tool to put the whole New Testament right back into a box of unattainable ladder that you must climb, that you will never see the end of. It's like thinking of it in the terms of something that is still yet to come. And adding it to our modern day context, it seems to be that obviously people from the 1800s are still finding a way to bring it into the new generation, and it's unattainable.
So I think the main message that John is trying to give to the church is God's servants have nothing to fear, which is the very opposite of how Revelation is so often used. the story's end is already written. God's going to be victorious. Oppressors of God's people are going to be destroyed. God's people will be vindicated. Mm-hmm. No, that's... Yeah, things may be rough for God's people from time to time, but that's not the end of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And even in a lighter note, the beauty of it's not even that we're going to be, like, those are going to be destroyed. It's just that, like, we have this beautiful chance to be part of God's world. And these people are obviously giving up an opportunity to have one of the best views they could possibly get. Like, do I want to look at a brick wall, or do I want to look at that? You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't even have to be so harsh as, like, you're all going to die.
Do you want the extra one back, or do you use it? Because I already have one. Or do you want...
I can take it.
I can't say enough, Mark, that I appreciate your time that you put into this very much.
Yeah. I think I have all the binders.